Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in State Farm versus Beekman.
May it please the court, Ms. Ron L. Maroney will present argument from petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Insurance Company. I'm also speaking today on behalf of Ted Heaton, the agent involved in this situation. State Farm has taken responsibility at the trial court level and even before for any involvement that Ted Heaton may have had in this case. This case presents the question of whether there must be a finding of a culpable mental state, knowing conduct, gross negligence, conscious inducement, or disregard in order to recover mental anguish damages in an Article 2121 case. This case arose over a $250,000 life insurance contract, which before it expired for non-payment of premiums, insured the life of respondent, deceased husband, David Beeston. As stated by the Court of Appeals at 861 Southwest 2nd, page 276, coverage ceased at the end of the grace period 3 days before Mr. Beeston was tragically killed on January 31, 1984. During the months that followed his death, specifically through about April 1984, inquiries were made as to coverage by or on behalf of his widow, Ms. Beeston. State Farm Life Insurance Company responded that coverage had expired, and then 2 years later, suit was brought. A jury trial was held in July of 1991 that the trial court found as a matter of law an ambiguity in the dividend provisions of the policy, specifically that they could be read to allow an available dividend accumulation sufficient to avoid the lapse. And of course, as is brief, State Farm does not agree with that position. But in any event, the trial court granted the motion for a directed verdict regarding coverage. In order to avoid commenting on the weight of the evidence, the jury was not told of the instructive verdict. The trial court also granted an instructive verdict for State Farm on the policy dating issue. There had been some concern or allegation that the policy had been backdated. But likewise, the jury was not instructed as to that much or granted a directed verdict in order not to comment on the weight of the evidence. The case went to the jury. The jury answered yes to a question whether State Farm engaged in any unfair or deceptive act or practice that was a producing cause of any damages to Ms. Beeston, but refused to find that it committed any false, misleading, or deceptive act or practice, any unconscionable action or course of action, negligence or gross negligence. It also refused to find that State Farm had waived any lapse of the policy. A knowing conduct question was conditioned on a yes answer to the unconscionable action question and was therefore not answered because the other one was answered no. The one yes answer to question number one allowed the jury to answer a damage question that inquired whether Ms. Beeston had been damaged in the amount of policy benefits or by mental anguish. It answered zero to the policy benefit subpart of the damage question, but $200,000 to the mental anguish subpart. The trial court disregarded the mental anguish award because there was no finding of knowing conduct. It awarded policy benefits, but did not trouble them because the jury did not find them resulted from State Farm's conduct, and the trial court would not hold that they did as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals modified the trial court's judgment to award the mental anguish damages, finding that Article 2121 of the Insurance Code does not require proof of knowing conduct. It also, because it did that, awarded prejudgment interest, treble, plus an algebraic calculation of attorney's fees. This court granted writ on our point of error number two, complaining that the Court of Appeals erred in awarding the mental anguish damages because proof of knowing conduct or culpable mental state is a prerequisite for such an award. Mental anguish damages.
Is it your position before this court that you owe nothing?
It is, Your Honor.
You're preserved.
We are. And I would be happy to address the other point, but I had
No, go ahead and take it on the one we've been.
Mental anguish damages are not recoverable for a violation of Article 2121 of the Insurance Code absent a finding of a culpable mental state, which, as I said before, would be like known conduct, gross negligence, conscious indifference. At common law, certain restrictions were placed on the recovery of mental anguish damages. The plaintiff must have suffered physical injury, or the defendant must have exhibited a culpable mental state, or the tort must have been of a type that inherently would be likely to cause primarily emotional or mental injury, such as the failure to deliver a death notice or mishandling of a report, that type of thing. Or, in fact, I think it was no later in the war, which was a little above the death of a family member. These common law restrictions on mental anguish damages were applied to the BCPA cases in Brown versus American Transfer and Storage Company, Farmers and Merchants State Bank versus Ferguson, which is at 617-918, and Luna versus North Star Dodge, 667-115, which was a decision out of this court in 1984. None of those cases relied on the DTPA to reach their conclusion that they were relying on the common law restriction on mental anguish damages. The actual damages recoverable under both the DTPA and Article 2121 are those recoverable at common law, according to Brown at 601 at 939. It follows that the common law restrictions would also apply. Nothing in either statute says that they should not, and they are especially appropriate because there is no proximate cause finding with regard to liability under either statute, so you don't have the foreseeability protection. The Supreme Court in Luna held that a knowing violation of the DTPA was sufficient to award mental anguish damages, and its rationale was that culpable conduct was on a continuum, with gross negligence being on one extreme, the less culpable extreme, then knowing conduct, then willful conduct, then intentional conduct on the most culpable extreme. The Supreme Court stated that if gross negligence was sufficient to allow a plaintiff to recover mental anguish damages, then so was knowing conduct. And it was referring to the Ferguson, I believe, case, which spoke in terms of gross negligence being required. It said if gross negligence was sufficient, then so was knowing conduct, as knowing conduct would be more culpable than gross negligence. This was understood to be a requirement of knowing conduct in DTPA cases because of the language of the Court of Appeals on remand, most likely, which was the recovery of mental anguish damages in a deceptive trade practices action brought pursuant to Section 17.50 of the DTPA may be obtained provided the complaint of acts were done knowingly. It used the word knowingly, so cases began to pick up that knowing conduct was required, but actually the Supreme Court in Luna had addressed different kinds of culpable conduct, and so had Brown and Ferguson and Duncan also versus Luke Johnson Ford before that. In 1987, this court did away with the physical injury requirement in St. Elizabeth Hospital versus Girard. Ms. Beeson argues that the removal of that requirement effectively removes the culpable mental state requirement, but it does not. After Girard, and in the last few years, there have been many assaults on the viability of Luna in light of Girard. The San Antonio Court of Appeals in Milt Ferguson Motor Company versus Duretsky, which is an 827-349, and it's a no-writ case, it also involves the DTPA, went so far as to hold that Luna had been overruled. This was a case cited by Beeson to the Court of Appeal to support its argument that Luna was not controlling. Then last year, in Boyles versus Kerr, the viability of Luna was reaffirmed in the court's dicta that willful or I believe gross negligence was required in order to recover mental anguish damages under the DTPA. Now the attack has shifted to the applicability of Luna, and whereas DTPA cases were cited against its viability, now they're distinguishable or argued to be distinguishable because they involve the DTPA instead of the insurance code. This attack is going on despite the fact that Beeson's attorneys admit in their reply brief to this court that there are significant gaps between the prohibitions of Article 2121 and the BCPA, as the statutes cross-reference and incorporate each other. Also, the editors of the Texas Consumer Law Reporter recently, in arguing that attorney's fees should be figured algebraically in BCPA cases, as they were in this case by the Court of Appeals and insurance code cases, argued that the DTPA and Article 2121 were passed by the same bill in 1973, and our statute is, and I don't always pronounce this, peri materia, and are to be construed in harmony with each other and not in conflict. The Corpus Christi Court of Appeals in Underwriters Life Insurance Company v. Cox at 746 Southwest 2nd 810, a 1988 no writ case, decided 1 year after Girard, did not question the applicability of Luna, after saying that physical injury is no longer a prerequisite to a recovery from mental anguish. It went on to hold that it is necessary to show the tortfeasor acted knowingly or with conscious indifference, causing a relatively high degree of mental pain and distress. Also, that was in 1988. In 1989, Joseph Chumley, writing for the St. Mary's Law Journal at 20 St. Mary's Law Journal 571, commented that physical injury was no longer required, and this stated, the only requirement for the recovery of mental anguish damages in a DTPA or Article 2121 case is to show that the defendant acted knowingly or with conscious indifference. Then again, back in Boyles v. Kerr a year ago, Justice Doggett dissented to the result, but not to the premise, that a culpable mental state must be shown to recover mental anguish damages. And at page 616 of the court's opinion in 855 Southwest 2nd, he cited Cobb for the proposition that to recover mental anguish damages in an insurance code action, it is necessary that the tortfeasor acted knowingly or with conscious indifference. Now, the Boyle decision did not expand the situations under which someone may recover mental anguish damage. It did not affect the claimant's right to recover mental anguish damages caused by a defendant's breach of some other legal duty. Because cases that it cites for that are not insurance cases. None of them are. All of them involve intentional acts or physical injury had been shown or some culpable mental state. Boyles also states that a special relationship may give rise to a duty which, if breached, would support an emotional distress award. And I believe this was picked up on by the Court of Appeals, and they argued, or they stated, that there's a special relationship, obviously, between an insurance company and its insurers. But the cases that the Boyles Court cited were the Stewart versus Western Union and Foley and Company versus Wyatt. The first is the negligent failure to get a death message to the family on time. The second was mishandling of a corpse. And again, no insurance cases were cited. The Boyles Court stated that there must be some specific duty of care that under the law arises from the relationship. Obviously, there's a general duty of good faith and fair dealing in the relationship that State Farm has with its insurer, but these cases address a more specific duty. Also, the existence of a special relationship does not abrogate the need to show a culpable mental state. The special relationship results or resulted in the creation of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, according to Arnold versus National County Mutual. But Arnold explicitly stated that exemplary damages and mental anguish damages are recoverable for a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing under the same principles allowing recovery of those damages in other tort actions, and that at 725 Southwest 2nd 168. Those principles include the common law restrictions, which were discussed above, and of course the physical manifestation requirement is out, but the culpable mental state requirement is still there. Therefore, a culpable mental state, at least for its negligence, is necessary for the recovery of mental anguish damages under the insurance code, just as it is under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. To hold otherwise would punish State Farm and other insurance carriers finding themselves in a similar position in the absence of any finding of culpability for refusing to pay benefits based on a reasonable interpretation of the policy. The Court of Appeals here found that State Farm's interpretation of the policy was reasonable. They found a competing reasonable in their eyes interpretation and therefore found an ambiguity. But State Farm would be, and insurance carriers would have exposure to unlimited extra-contractual damages for non-culpable conduct, and that goes beyond protecting some insurance consumers to punishing all insurance consumers with higher premiums, because that would be passed on to the consumers. It makes it difficult to evaluate risk and exposure if non-culpable, reasonable policy construction can open the floodgates to extra-contractual damages. I think the law is clear that common law and the application to the DPPA, and then because the statutes are so closely connected, it is also clear that there must be a finding of some type of knowing culpable mental state, including knowing conduct, in order for mental anguish damages to be recovered. And I would urge the court to affirm the judgment of the trial court on that basis, that reverse and render the Court of Appeals and their decision. And unless there are questions.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark Kincaid will present arguments to respondents.
May it please the court. I'm Mark Kincaid. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Terry Beeston. I'd like to start, I want to dispel one myth in this case. I understand this court has a great concern about the liability of insurance carriers, making sure that there are not unlimited exemplary damages, making sure that reasonable conduct does result in excessive liability. Anyone who follows the court's decisions can see that that's a recurring concern. This is not a case of an insurance carrier being held liable because of its reasonable misconstruction of the policy. That wasn't what the jury decided the case based on. That was the instructive verdict. That's why we got contract damages from the trial court. But as Ms. Bromley pointed out, the jury wasn't told about that because Judge Hart was concerned lest he comment on the weight of the evidence. What the jury finding of unfair insurance prices was based on was not innocent mistakes or reasonable interpretations. It was, and the evidence is spelled out in the Court of Appeals opinion. It's also spelled out in great detail in my briefing in this court. The evidence showed that State Farm denied coverage because they said the policy had lapsed by 3 days. They fell outside coverage by 3 days. But the evidence showed State Farm had unilaterally backdated the policy by 3 days, with no right under the contract to do so, with no notice to the consumers that they were doing so. State Farm's own representative admitted, but for that unilateral act that was not authorized by the contract or anything else, there would have been coverage.
You're saying that the statement that the trial court found that had not occurred is incorrect?
I don't believe that's what Ms. Maroney intended to say to the court. I asked the trial court to grant an instructive verdict on coverage for two reasons. One was the policy was ambiguous on its accumulativity. Judge Hart agreed with that. The other basis was that as a contractual matter, they had no right to backdate the policy. Therefore, as a contractual matter, if that backdating were thrown out, there would be coverage. He chose not to grant an instructive verdict on that basis, but that went to the jury as part of the unfair insurance. He didn't say as a matter of law it was okay. He just declined to find as a matter of law that it was a breach of contract. But there's more. That was just one point, and these are spelled out in the briefing. The agent had represented, with State Farm's permission and approval, that he would take care of the Beeston's personal needs tethered to their personal situation, which was a young, struggling couple with a small child. Then he sold them whole life insurance without offering them term life, much more expensive. When they got into financial trouble, which he was very aware of, the records were replete with evidence of that, he never offered to substitute them to a less expensive policy, which he could have. He never offered, as many people in State Farm's own training will concede, he never said, you need to insure the breadwinner. Rather than pay for the wife's policy, if you're having trouble making ends meet, pay for the husband's policy. Terry Beeston's policy never lapsed. As David said, hers stayed in effect even though she wasn't the primary breadwinner. this was the type of evidence, the contrast between what was promised, what he said he would do for them, and what he did and failed to do.
Mr. Kincaid, let me direct your attention to, on the point of error that we granted, obviously the court's concerned about whether knowing conduct is required to award mental language damages under the insurance code. Now that there's no requirement of a physical manifestation of an injury in order to award mental anguish damages, and if there is no requirement of knowing conduct or culpable conduct on the part of the defendant in order to award mental anguish damages, what standard will the jury apply? In a case where a plaintiff sues asking for mental anguish damages, is it essentially an unlimited discretion on the part of the jury as to how much and they reward?
It's not unlimited, but as the court knows, mental anguish damages are a problem because you want guarantees of innocence. That's why we had physical manifestations. We looked at the plaintiff's reaction to satisfy ourselves that it was genuine. Then we also had the defendant's culpable mental state as an alternative. If the defendant acted badly enough, then the law would presume that mental anguish damages were followed. Those were the two problems that Luna talked about. When Gerard knocked out physical manifestation, it's not that it necessarily cut out the culpable mental state. It's just if you had two paths and the courtroom moves, as it did in Gerard and affirming Bowles versus Kirk physical manifestations, no one would ever choose the culpable mental state path. They would base it on a breach of a duty and proof of mental anguish. To directly answer your question, there are two options. One is to recognize that it is now open-ended. There is no arbitrary standard like physical manifestation, which Gerard and Bowles both agreed that was arbitrary. And we do, to a certain extent, have to trust juries and reviewing courts to look to see the genuineness of the claim, to see are these circumstances where mental anguish likely would follow. That's kind of the future of where do mental anguish damages go from here. What I'd really like to rely on in this case is the past. Actual damages under the DPA in 2121 are common law damages, at least. No more, no less. Whatever the common law gives, we get under the statute. Under the common law, there was always this third path, and that is where the nature of the conduct, the nature of the transaction itself, provides those circumstantial guarantees that it's a genuine claim. That's the Stewart versus Western Union case. 1885 decision. The fellow goes down, he says, my brother is sick, I'm expecting a telegram. If you get a telegram, please bring it to me. They fail to deliver it on time. As a result, his brother is dead and buried before he gets the news. In 1885, this Supreme Court said, in those circumstances, the death of a loved one, the failure to deliver the telegram, that is a sufficiently good circumstantial guarantee that it's a genuine claim to allow recovery of mental anguish damages without physical manifestations, without culpable mental state. Death is a special type of injury. Moore versus Laleva, wrongful death. You get mental anguish damages without physical manifestations, without a culpable mental state. In the third category, death of a loved one and mishandling of the loved one's body, that's Klassen versus Benford. It's cited in the briefing. Those three categories relating to death, historically, the court, without question, has said you get mental anguish damages without physical manifestations, without culpable mental state. What I'm suggesting to the court is that if Mr. Stewart could get mental anguish damages because Western Union didn't deliver the telegram and he suffered extra anguish from the death of his brother, then Terry Beeston is likewise entitled to recover mental anguish damages under that third path. Because it's a life insurance policy sold to a young woman as a beneficiary, knowing that she will be the widow and will have a child, because that was part of the information in the application. Under the circumstances, State Farm knew as well the mental anguish she would suffer if it denied the claim, as Western Union knew Mr. Stewart would suffer if it didn't deliver his telegram.
Are you advocating the recovery of mental anguish damages for breach of contract?
No, sir. Not at all.
The same mental anguish would occur on denial of a claim based on some contract, if that's what it is.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that, I think, is a key to this case. And you hit on it in Morial. And even though there's disagreement on the punitive damages part of Morial, you were at least 7-2 on this point, and I think now I know that it's important to keep in mind the three tiers. Breach of contract, which just gets you to policy benefits. It wouldn't get you mental anguish damages.
What's the principle basis that you're relying on to say that? If the expectation of the insurance company is essentially the same, that whether recovery is on a non-culpable insurance code violation or merely a denial of the benefits of the contract.
Well, I respectfully reject the notion that there is a non-culpable insurance code violation. It's an unfair practice. That is how it's worded. A jury has to at least find it as unfair. And just as you wrote in Morial, to get compensatory damages beyond the breach of contract here, you have to show bad faith. You were talking about common law bad faith. 2121 is statutory bad faith. It's an analogous type of theory. Once you show that something more, and that is a violation of this statutory duty, that is what allows recovery of compensatory damages. And it's wrong to say you have to show knowing misconduct to get actual damages, because that's the trigger then to go on to exemplary damages for trial damages. What is particularly ironic in this case, and shows it's unsupported by the common law and the statute, is this was an old act case. This was automatic treble damages. Terry Beeson didn't have to show knowingly even to get treble damages. Yet she has to come back and show a culpable mental state to get her actual damages. That turns the statute on its head. Perhaps it wasn't a good idea. Perhaps it's a little bit too strong to have automatic treble damages. The legislature's fixed that now. Now we do have knowingly as the trigger. But the result this court is being asked to embrace is that you apply a punitive standard as an obstacle to recovery of actual damages. What you said on the three tiers in Morial, I think, applies equally to this statutory type of thing. It's important to keep them distinct. And that's what I'm asking for, is no more and no less than what the common law provides. But someone under the DCPR 2121 should be liberally construed to protect consumers, should be at least entitled to what they get under the common law. And in 1885, we recognized this third area where there are circumstantial guarantees of genuineness. And I don't think it's any different now in this type of case. I obviously can't spend every minute of my time talking about the Stewart case, but if I could, I would. And I've briefed it pretty thoroughly, because not only the parallel is perfect. The court then talked about the heightened duty, talked about the knowledge that the defendant had of the undertaking, and how when they failed to perform, the loss wasn't just the price paid or the thing bargained for, it was the anguish. That's no less true in a life insurance case. Maybe other types of policies, maybe other types of consumer claims won't fit the Stewart pattern, but this case does. And I can't ask you, I know this court is hard to make the rules that broadly apply, and that's part of why you're supposed to grant is things that apply broadly. I don't know where the boundary of the Stewart rule will be in other cases. What I do know is that Terry Beeson is well within that boundary. And that's what I'm asking for, is not really an advancement in the law, but simply apply Stewart. In Bowles versus Kerr, and I'd like to talk about that for a moment, I respectfully submit that the reference to Lane is just dicta, and regrettably, incorrect dicta. Luna never said you had to have knowingly. Luna was asked whether, assuming you had to have knowingly, or assuming you had to have conscious indifference, was the knowing finding that was already in the case enough? You all know Bowles versus Kerr wasn't the DPA case. I haven't read the briefing of Bowles, but I assume it wasn't thoroughly briefed, wasn't thoroughly argued. There were a lot of other things in that case for people to talk about besides the DTPA. So I hope that the court will not feel too bound by that one passing reference, because there's so much in Bowles that the court did hold that supports recovery of mental anguish damages. You went back and said, Gerard was right, no physical manifestations. Well, that leaves that path open. In Bowles versus Curry, you went back and said that while you weren't trying to broaden recovery, you also weren't trying to restrict it. Bowles versus Kerr, as I read it, was an attack on the theory of liability, that negligent infliction as a theory of liability was gone. not that mental anguish damages were any more difficult or less difficult to recover in other types of cases. So the court specifically said that you weren't changing the law with respect to breach of another legal duty. We have breached another legal duty, a violation of 2121. I'm not asking you to do any more than Bowles versus Kerr said.
Mr. Kincaid, on 2121, what is the result of a finding of violation under 2121? What happens differently under a violation of 2121 in terms of the insurance company's liability?
Differently from what, Your Honor?
From simply being ordered to pay under the terms of the contract.
It would be compensatory damages. Although, admittedly, under breach of contract, we all know the Hadley versus Baxendale rule and damages that are within the contemplation of the parties. Perhaps in some cases there would be other damages, but what is clear is breach of contract, you get the benefits.
Okay, but, well, you might be getting ahead of me here a little bit. Under 2121, you have an insurance policy, they don't pay. You have a finding that the insurance company breached 2121. What does 2121 say? You recover in addition to the contract, what you should have recovered in the contract.
It says actual damages.
Doesn't 2121 actually say a penalty on actual damages?
No, what 2121 says, as it's written down, it says a person who prevails may recover actual damages caused by the conduct. Then it goes on to say, on a finding of knowingly, then you get treble damages. That's what's recoverable when you go beyond showing the breach of contract to showing that it was unfair, that it was a misrepresentation. And I invite the court to look at the footnote in the Court of Appeals opinion. It sets up the question we want under. It's not reasonable interpretations, it's misrepresentations, it's failing to disclose information. It is something beyond just the breach of contract, and that something in this case is actual damages. Now, as I mentioned, because this case was under the pre-1985 version of Article 2121, you got triple damages automatically, and that was just what the statute said. If I may return to Bowles versus Kerr, the other point the court made is recognizing that where there is a special relationship that gives rise to a duty, that likewise is a basis for mental anguish damages. And this court knows that's what Arnold and Miranda and any number of other cases, most recently the Natividad case, were all about, that there is a special relationship between insurer and insured giving rise to this common law duty. All the legislature did in 2121, as Judge Gamage well knows, is recognize the same concept that insurance is a special area and they impose statutory duties. So the special relationship language of Bowles versus Kerr, which the Court of Appeals relied on, justifies recovery of mental anguish damages in this case. It's not a new cause of action like negligent infliction.
So let me get it straight. First, you're talking about this being involving death, and that was the third path.
Yes.
And that seemed to me you were setting up quite a bit of difference between a life insurance policy and a disability policy, say, of the type we had in Forbow. But now you're talking about really any insurance situation.
Well, what I'm trying to point out, Your Honor, is under the Stewart line, that is more the guarantee that the damage claim is genuine. As I understood Bowles versus Kerr, the other legal duty or the special relationship, that focuses on liability that allows you to get those damages. Stewart focused on what type of proof, what type of circumstantial guarantees would allow you to get that. And as I said, I'm not sure what other types of cases, perhaps someone would be upset about losing their car, but I doubt they'd be as upset on an auto policy as they would be on a life policy. Death is a special category of cases, wrongful death, mishandling of a corpse, mishandling of death telegrams. That's the law in Texas and has been for 109 years. What I'm respectfully submitting is if Mr. Stewart, as this court reaffirmed in Bowles versus Kerr, had a legitimate right to mental anguish damages in the facts of his case, Terry Beeston, who was promised life insurance benefits, who was promised a certain level of protection by State Farm, with him being aware of the risk, if they fail to discharge those duties to her, that is equally a legitimate claim. Where other cases fall, I'm not prepared to argue, but where death cases fall is within the Stewart versus Western Union rule. I'd like to suggest to the court there's a very clear problem in this case. State Farm has waived this argument. State Farm never objected that the 2121 issue or the Millennium issue didn't have a knowingly element. And Rule 274 says that they need to object at a time when we can fix the problem. I'm representing a woman who doesn't have to prove knowingly to get treble damages and who shouldn't have to prove knowingly to get actual damages, and we're submitting it to a jury with no objection whatsoever saying you cannot get your mental anguish damages under 2121 without a knowing finding. Knowingly was submitted in connection with unconscionability under the DTPA because unconscionability is a pure DTPA cause of action. It wasn't subject to the automatic trailing.
But you lost that issue anyway, right? I mean,
I did. I did.
Do they have to object to an error in an issue that you not answered favorably to you?
And the cases are cited in my briefing. They have to object that the 2121 issue doesn't have a knowing element, or with the knowing element submitted as it was in connection with unconscionability, they have to at least object that it's improperly conditioned. This isn't new law outside the cases in the brief. Having failed to object that a knowing finding is required, they're not in a position to argue that in this court. And I suggest to the court that the proper way...
That was a predicated issue the jury didn't reach, correct?
That's right. They didn't find unconscionability, so they didn't get to knowingly. And the case law could not be more clear that it's their duty to object so that I can either correct the problem if I perceive it as a problem, or I can tell the trial court, Your Honor, I disagree and I'm willing to take the risk. So I submit to the court that it may be a proper way to resolve this case to simply dismiss it because the point was not preserved. Alternatively, I'd like to ask the court to simply affirm the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals had several grounds in its opinion for affirming mental anguish damages, but two of them were the duty theories under Bowles versus Kerr, which are clearly correct and are clearly sufficient to support recovery in this case. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Maroney, if we accept your position that mental culpability is a requirement for the recovery of mental anguish, how do we distinguish between a negligence claim with a claim for mental anguish and a gross negligence claim?
I'm trying to make sure I understand your question. In a negligence claim for mental anguish, such as a personal injury type claim?
Yes.
Okay, in those cases, you don't have to worry about the culpable mental state requirement if you have the physical manifestation, and almost all of them do. In a gross negligence case, that is a culpable mental state, so you have met that requirement. There's been talk about the three common law restrictions, the first being physical manifestations, which of course we already talked about in connection with the Gerard opinion, the second being the culpable mental state requirement, and the third being the circumstantial guarantees of genuineness.
Is it your position that if there is no physical manifestation, then you essentially have to prove gross negligence in order to get a recovery for mental anguish?
In any type of a case?
Well, I don't know.
In this particular case?
You're just simply saying that the culpable mental state is necessary to recovery of mental anguish, and I'm trying to find... You made the distinction between where there's physical manifestation and not. So let's assume no physical manifestation. Let's assume a claim for mental anguish. I don't care what case it is. It's your statement that mental anguish must be predicated upon a finding of gross negligence if there's no physical manifestation.
I would expand that and not just say gross negligence, but any culpable mental state from gross negligence, knowing conduct, willful conduct, intentional, or if it's one of the narrow class of cases where the circumstantial guarantees, such as the Stewart case that has been discussed, where you would expect mental or emotional, where they would be foreseeable, clearly foreseeable, in fact, inevitable, that you would have mental or emotional damages.
why isn't that this case? Can't you always foresee that if a widow is denied death benefits due to an insurance code violation, is it likely that she'll suffer mental anguish?
Well, Your Honor, it's our position that this does not fit into that narrow third class, and the reason is, in fact, I believe counsel has referred to it in his briefing anyway, it's a peace of mind argument that when you buy insurance, you buy peace of mind, that type of thing, especially life insurance where you would expect that a death would somehow be involved sooner or later in a life insurance situation. But the first of all, I'd like to draw the court's attention that there was no finding of foreseeability whatsoever in the speaking case. The negligent and gross negligent questions were answered no. So there's no finding by the court that these damages were foreseeable, that they were approximately caused by this conduct. And also, I found a case out of Louisiana I'd like to mention to the court. Its style is Cano Corporation versus Louisiana Health Service and Indemnity Company. And I see that I did not have the reporter site, but I will get that to the court. From 1978, and the plaintiff made an intellectual tranquility argument, which is very similar to Ms. Beeson's peace of mind argument. And the court said that the plaintiff's argument could apply to almost any contract situation because the purpose of entering into an agreement is generally to fulfill a need or a desire. And as to an insurance company, the obligation is simply a duty to pay if the conditions of the policy are met. And of course, it's our position in this particular case that they were not met. This court also went on to point out that all contracts, claims on contracts, involve peace of mind and intellectual tranquility. So that these cases, the Smith-Stewart case, and the Foley case, it was inevitable in those situations that if you don't deliver a death notice and someone does not get to visit with a relative before they die, of course mental anguish or mental or emotional damages will result, but we are not at that extreme. And there's a very good discussion of this whole area in the amicus brief that was filed, I believe, yesterday by Continental Casualty. They, I believe, they wrote several pages to it. I had a chance to read through it once because I got it late last night, but it falls into the area that you're asking about. I would like to point out that I don't believe I have stated the court's position on the instructive verdict on the policy dating, but the language in the statement of facts is on pages 1064 to 1060. Also, the evidence in this case has been hotly contested, and the mental anguish finding has been the jury's discretion. But that's why it's so important to have these common law restrictions on mental anguish, because the jury, once the jury makes a finding, as I was hearing a recent argument yesterday, I heard it brought up, it's very, very difficult to disturb that finding.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in this cause and concludes the court's oral submission docket for the day. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Please rise.